Senate Committee on Health and Human Services together, please. We're going to have a work session on House Bill 3328, and so Representative Gelser, would you please come up? And you do have some...
Thank you, Chair Morissette. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, and you heard this bill on Monday and scheduled the work session for today. Some of you heard this bill.
So there may be some questions.
Right. And would you like me to give the brief 30-second overview?
I give 45 seconds.
45 seconds. Okay, without going into substantial detail, what this bill basically says is that when there is an allegation of abuse made regarding a child, and that investigator, law enforcement, or child protective services worker goes out to investigate that allegation, they encounter a child with a suspicious physical injury, two things will now happen under this bill. One, those injuries will be photographed so that that can be part of the record both for the evaluation and determination of whether or not that allegation of abuse is substantiated, and so that can be also available to medical professionals, and the child will see a doctor within 48 hours, and that will become part of the child abuse investigation. It also allows for a critical incident response team to be convened anytime there's a fatality due to abuse or neglect of a child that had previously been known to the agency, and it requires some reporting back from the multidisciplinary teams on the implementation of Carley's Law. That's the other name for House Bill 3328. And the genesis of this bill was a death that happened in my legislative district of a 3-year-old child who was beaten to death after an allegation of abuse was unsubstantiated. And as the community looked back at those issues, it was clear, and we looked at other issues of child fatalities and ongoing abuse, that issues of photography and access to adequately trained medical personnel were very important. I have two amendments to bring to you today that are basically technical amendments. And this bill did pass unanimously out of the committee on the House side, and also unanimously off the House floor, 59-0. The first amendment that I hope you have before you are the -8 amendments, and this makes a very brief change. Under that definition of suspicious physical injury, it removes malnutrition and failure to thrive. And the reason for that is this is a bill about physical abuse, and especially if you look at methamphetamine house busts, this would really broaden the scope pretty significantly. And at the request of the Child Abuse Assessment Center physicians, inserting the language multiple injuries of different types. So if an investigator is seeing a child that has cuts and bruises and broken bones, that's also probably pretty suspicious and should lead to this higher level of investigation. The -11 amendments come at the request of the Juvenile Rights Project. JRP is also in support of this bill, and this just clarifies the rights that juveniles have at the age of 15 or older to consent to or deny consent for medical treatment, and clarifying that this bill, these requirements for medical examinations, do not supersede that child's or that minor individual's right to consent or deny consent for medical exam and treatment. So those are the -8s and the -11s. I had also been asked to briefly put a couple of things on the record following the testimony the other day. The first was that JRP didn't have the opportunity to testify that day, the Juvenile Rights Project, and they are in support of the bill, along with the Oregon District Attorney's Association. There was some discussion there about scope of injury, and the intent here is that when there's an allegation of abuse, so the child, there's already a suspicion that the child is being abused because there's been an allegation and a screener has sent someone out. When that child is demonstrating these kinds of injuries, we want to make sure that there's a medical assessment so that a medical provider is making a medical diagnosis rather than a law enforcement officer or a child protective services worker. This protects the child, it protects the parents, and it protects law enforcement and the child protective services worker. So it is the intent that those injuries would be examined by a physician, a nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant. There was finally a question about the implementation date. There is an emergency clause on this. Obviously, immediately after the governor signs, the multidisciplinary teams will not at that moment have designated their designated medical practitioners that are these resources to the multidisciplinary teams. The effective date means that these multidisciplinary teams will immediately begin work to identify those people. But, of course, upon implementation, we would expect that the department would move towards making sure these kids are having the photography protocols followed, as well as making sure the kids are having access to a physician. As provided in the bill, it provides off-ramps for when one of these designated physicians aren't available, so the bill provides those safeguards. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I first I want to say I like the amendment, especially the A8s. I think that's a good change. I question the malnutrition and failure to thrive, how that really fit in, because that's really, and so that's a good change. And we are in work session.
Yes, we are in work session.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash A8 amendment to House Bill 3328.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the dash A8 amendments to House Bill 3328. Discussion? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A11 amendments to House Bill 3328.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the dash A11 amendments to House Bill 3328. Comments?
Single comments?
So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3328 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3328 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm supportive conceptually of this. I still have some concern over implementation in some of our more rural counties. And I guess we will be able to review progress in February. And those concerns also address the emergency clause and impacts there as well. So I almost wish the emergency clause wasn't on it, but this will give the House some time to think about whether that should be there when it comes back for concurrence over there. So.
What? I was preoccupied for a moment.
I understand. Just a concern about the emergency clause as far as implementation. I would say it will give the members of the House some time to consider whether that should be removed, because this will have to go back to the House for concurrence. And if it's thought that maybe it would be better off without it, we could go to conference and remove it. So, but let's move it here now. So.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Hearing none. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Montanderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Excuse.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Green?
Aye.
Chair Marshall?
Aye. House Bill 3328, as amended, passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Berger will carry the bill. Thank you very, very much. Okay, we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2184. Okay, 2184 specifies that deputy director, deputy, and principal assistant physicians, more than one, in the Department of Human Services are in unclassified service. And if you would like to expand on that.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2184 specifies that the deputy director and principal assistant personnel positions in the Department of Human Services are unclassified service employees who serve at the pleasure of the director of DHS. The committee does have before them the Dash 2 amendment, which exempts the deputy director, assistant director of DHS from statutes that limit the number of hours persons receiving service retirement allowance can work per year for a public employer if the governor approves exemption. It declares emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Louise Milton Green, would you come up, please? And Patty O'Sullivan, of course.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Louise Milton Green, and I am the administrator for the Office of Human Resources with DHS, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2184. This really is a clarification to ORS 409.150, and it's really concerning employment of positions within the Department of Human Services that are in the unclassified service. And so this really does not involve positions that are represented by a union. This only clarifies our current organization structure. Typically what you see with unclassified service positions is these are positions that are also considered executive service positions or serve at an at-will service, which means that the appointment can be terminated at any point in time for with or without cause. Again, this is necessary to alleviate some confusion that we've had with our statute so that folks actually understand that they are serving in an at-will status. These types of appointments are made by the director or a deputy director. The types of positions and people that you see in these positions are individuals like Clyde Psyche, like our deputy of finance, Ramona Foley, James Taves. These are just some examples. Can I answer any questions at this point?
Thank you. Patty?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the...
Patricia.
Well, yeah, Patricia Margaret Mary O'Sullivan, actually.
Wow, it gets better.
It does. I'm the Director for Public Policy for the Department of Human Services, and I'm just here to answer any questions on the amendment as to the actual bill that Louise just testified on. I would also be an at-will employee, and if Bruce doesn't like what I do, he can say goodbye, and I understand that, but sometimes there's been some other problems in the past with others not understanding it. But I'm here to answer any questions on the amendment when you get to that.
Senator Cruz is perusing the bill very carefully. I don't have any questions. No questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We will close the work session. I close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2184. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to 2184.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendment to 2184, House Bill 2184. Discussion? No discussion? So move.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2184 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 2184 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I will be voting in favor of the bill today, but reserve the right to be opposed on the floor. I need to have a little more thought on this.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger?
Excuse.
Senator Gross?
Aye.
Senator Montaigne?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. House Bill 2184 will go to the floor with a D-pass recommendation, and Senator George will carry the bill. Sir. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2386.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2386A allows a licensed physical therapist with a doctoral degree in physical therapy to use a professional designation doctor of physical therapy, prohibits any other person or business entity from using this designation, extends the period for which physical therapists can treat a patient before being required to refer to another healthcare practitioner from 30 to 45 days. Committee has before them three sets of amendments, the -A7, the -A8, and the -A9. All three sets of amendments, they remove language that allows a licensed physical therapist to use the professional designation doctor of physical therapy. The A87 extends the period for which physical therapists can continue therapy before being required to refer from 45 to 60 days. The -A8 extends direct access to 90 days, and the -A9 extends direct access to 120 days. All three also clarify some exemption language. That's out in all three of them. Yeah.
Okay, Tracy and Rick.
E.
E.
Sorry.
Oh.
Okay, I've been called lots of things.
Haven't we all?
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Retton, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I'd like to first thank you for hearing House Bill 2386A today and for hearing our support of this bill. This bill passed unanimously out of the House, there are three amendments, as you've already heard before you today, that we've proposed. The amendments would, you've already heard all three contain the same language to remove portions of the Angros bill that would have required a physical therapist who has a doctor of physical therapy degree and who wishes to use the term doctor to designate their professional designation following that individual's name with the words doctor of physical therapy. So I don't know if that confuses you or not, but it's been removed. So I don't think we can dwell too much, but all the amendments also contain the same language in terms of the exemption language. Really, this represents a cleanup in terms of existing language. There is the removal of one portion of the language dealing with massage practice at a bona fide athletic club. The reason for that is that language is extremely old, and we believe that any person who's practicing massage would be covered under the exemption language for healthcare practitioners who are licensed under the state. Mm-hmm. And there's a more broad exemption, and now that they are licensed and athletic trainers as well, they would fit into that category. So it's just that it's very old language. There's also some additional exemptions for anybody who is traveling with a touring theater company and an athletic team and not in the state more than 60 days. There's also an educational related exemption there. The exemption language actually did exist on the House side. It did contain one portion, however, that would have protected the term physical therapy. So when we removed the language relating to the protection of the term physical therapy on the House side, all of that language was removed, but there still is some good additions, I think, in that language that we wanted to keep in the bill. In terms of the amendments, the one differing aspect of the three amendments is the direct access issue. And I think that's probably the most important portion of those amendments that we can talk about today. In terms of physical therapy, direct access means that a patient can seek physical therapy services directly or without a physician referral. Currently in Oregon, since 1994, so 13 years now, I think that's correct, Oregon has had direct access to physical therapy, but it's been limited to 30 days. 43 other states across the U.S. have direct access to physical therapy services. And you'll see in line 6 of the amendments, that's where that change occurs in the time frame. And so we're looking at 69 to 120 20 days. We wanted to put that forward to you today to have a good discussion about what is the most appropriate length of time for a patient to be able to get the services directly from a physical therapist. The bill on the House side started off with unlimited access to physical therapy. We had a feeling that wouldn't last. We were going to take it to 120, and we went to 45 to get it out of committee, knowing that the conversation it was represented that the chair of the committee was okay with us having the conversation on the Senate side. Again, in terms of the history of direct access, it's existed in Oregon for over 13 years. We feel like this is an unnecessary and an arbitrary limit to the access that a patient can have, which ultimately creates a burden for that patient and increases the cost of the healthcare system. The extension of the 30-day limit can reduce delays of service provided by physical therapists. These delays in service result in higher costs, decreased functional outcomes, and frustration of patients. This is especially true for those patients who are paying out of pocket. This language applies to them as well. So somebody who is paying independently without insurance out of pocket still has to go to a physician after that 30-day limit is up. The thing that's been nice about this, preparing this testimony, is there's a lot of research and a lot of data that would support this increase in terms of patient safety, cost effectiveness, and quality of care. And you'll see those are outlined in my testimony. I won't go into too much detail in respect of your time today. But in terms of patient safety, both liability insurers and the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy affirm that direct access does not jeopardize the health, safety, or welfare of patients. We've included in your packet a letter from Affinity Insurance Services. They are a major liability insurance provider of physical therapists nationwide. They don't screen for direct access in underwriting and have found, and they don't charge a premium differential either, which would suggest that they have found no risk associated. They also looked at their competitors to see what they did, and none of their competitors were underwriting for direct access. So they did a comparison of those with direct access in states and those without and found that there was no increased risk. The Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy, which is comprised of 53 PT or physical therapist licensing jurisdictions within the United States, has also looked at data and has found no evidence of increased number or severity of final disciplinary actions in those jurisdictions with unlimited direct access to physical therapy. The mission of the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy is to protect the public by providing service and leadership that promotes safe and competent physical therapy practice. Furthermore, the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board has taken a position in support of this increase to direct access in Oregon and has taken no action against the licensee related to patient safety and direct access. Other studies to mention have looked at patient safety as it relates to direct access and have found that physical therapists are capable of providing safe and effective care for patients with musculoskeletal conditions in a direct access setting at a reduced cost to the healthcare system and employers. Another study looked at military physical therapy. The military uses a direct access model, and they've done studies to look at whether that posed an increased risk to their patients as well. It was a very comprehensive study and found that there was absolutely no increased risk to the patients that were in the direct access setting. In terms of education, I won't go into great detail as a professor is here today from Pacific University who can speak to that more a little bit better than I can. But I'll simply say that physical therapists are well qualified to identify when a patient's signs or symptoms are outside of their scope of practice and require further diagnosis of potential underlying conditions. Current law requires and will continue to require a physical therapist to make this referral onto a provider, another provider, when signs or symptoms are present or when physical therapy is contraindicated. In terms of cost effectiveness, again, there's a lot of data, a lot of evidence that would suggest that this increased direct access can reduce costs to the system. I'll quickly mention just one study that was done looking at Blue Cross Blue Shield claims, I think in the state of Maryland, if I recall correctly. The total paid claims for physician referral episodes to physical therapists were 123% higher than paid direct access claims. This represents a difference of an average of $1,232 for each claim. Physician referral episodes were 65% longer, generated 67% more physical therapy claims, and resulted in 60% more office visits than direct access episodes. The study also found that patients were prescribed more muscle relaxants, narcotic analgesics. I hope I got that right, Senator. Also experienced more reoccurrences of injury. Again, this 30-day referral requirement applies to all patients, including those paying out of pocket. So when those costs are felt, they're felt for individual patients. In terms of quality of care, and this is my last part here, the delays in access resulting from the referral requirement are of particular concern to the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. There's a direct relationship between wait times and a patient's ability to access physical therapy, and it's problematic in ensuring the best possible outcomes for those patients. The longer a patient waits to receive physical therapy care, the less likely they are to have optimum functional outcomes, which can impact their ability to return to work. In rural areas, this is a larger problem, as access to physicians can be more difficult and can create further delays in continuing physical therapy care. I've also included a letter from a patient that I had received in February when the bill was on the House side, and I blacked out the patient's name because today I just had a panic moment of, well, I don't know if he wanted me to share that at this point. He did. It was open to sharing that on the House side and sent it on to Senator Winters, his legislator, and Representative Berger on the House side. His situation was that he had a primary care physician who retired. He accessed physical therapy service directly and was paying out of pocket for those services. The 30 days came up, and he was told, you need to get a physician referral to continue on with your care. He felt like the care was beneficial to him, but he needed more care than 30 days. So this individual was very frustrated that he had to pay. Well, first off, find a new primary care physician to see him, make the appointment, pay the money, and then continue on with the care that he was receiving. I'll conclude by saying that we urge your support of this bill and the amendments to increase patient access to physical therapy services. I understand that there's opposition to the bill. I would just address their arguments by reiterating the numerous data and research which shows that this increase to access is safe and effective for patients who choose to take advantage of it. And it would also point to the potential decrease in cost and, most importantly, increases to quality of care. And just to clarify, this doesn't have an impact on insurance. So if your insurance provider requires a referral, that will still apply. We appreciate and share in the opponent's concerns for patient safety, as does the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, as that is their mission. And we wouldn't be putting this bill forward if we felt like it would jeopardize patient safety in any way. Thank you for your time, and I'd be willing to answer any questions that you might have.
Hi. I'm Ricky Sussick, and I'm representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association, Chair Morissette and committee. Tracy does a great job of sort of giving our testimony and the general background. It's interesting. I know a lot of you because I've been talking to you about this for many years. And it's just sort of interesting to me that any of you and any of us can go to an occupational therapist or a psychologist or a massage therapist or an athletic trainer and, you know, any number, speech person, any number of things. But for some reason, this historic sort of limitation on physical therapy has been out there. And, you know, as Senator Moniz Anderson, as you know from your profession, as professions grow and expand their knowledge and expand their education, things change. And so what we're trying to say now is that, you know, we have doctor of physical therapy, masters of physical therapy programs, and some other people will speak to that. But we have the education. We are able to treat patients without a referral from a physician. We're able to recognize if there's something that they need to go to another practitioner for. And so we're just going to keep sort of trying to chip away at this, sort of what we consider to be sort of an artificial barrier for everyone to get to a physical therapist should they want to.
Thank you. We have 14 chiropractors lined up to testify. Vern, would you please come up? And Joel Arista, who traveled over 100 miles, would you please come up? And hopefully you can... Oh, we have a volunteer. I would like you to do some summation if possible, or else I'm going to put time limits on everybody's speaking. That's a lot of testimony, and might be some redundancy. So if you would go ahead and introduce yourself, please. Sunny, do you want to start?
Okay, I can. Not waste time.
Give us your name. And
I'm Dr. Sunny Kirsten from Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here to testify in opposition to this particular bill. One of the few doctors in the state that works with a knowledge base of both disciplines, I have a particular clear understanding of this. For many years before I became a doctor, I was a critical care nurse working in emergency room and operating room and every level of intensive care. One of the things that I noticed is in looking at their curriculum for the physical therapist is they have no nutrition and no biochemistry. So, and many people don't understand the need of nutrients and that type of thing at a time of crisis, at a time of motor vehicle accidents or big traumas, falls, burns, that kind of thing. So should a patient see a physical therapist in the beginning, they're not going to receive the nutritional support that can help them speed that recovery along. They're not going to receive the type of analgesia that will help them to get past the problems. The other piece that concerns me is the minimal hours of imaging. 15 hours versus 300 is a big difference. How are they going to know what particular type of imaging should they perform on this particular problem? A third area for me is in the differential diagnosis. How do you know what that obesity or that cardiovascular disease or that chronic diabetes is going to do to those tissues? Do they know how to prepare for that, work around that, work with it, or stumble into other problems? So I am concerned about this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sable, representing the Chiropractic Association of Oregon, and you have my written testimony. I won't belabor it, but to us, this is a, and we're here. I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. To us, this is a public safety issue. For those who wish to be direct access portal of entry care providers, they must be able to diagnose. They must be able to see the red flags that can be harbingers to frank pathology or life-threatening diseases that can masquerade as simple back pain or mid-back pain and the like. And so as a public safety issue, to expand direct access to physical therapists would, in our view, be a problem. 60, 90, 120 days would be a concern. As you know, most consumers, they'll wait weeks or months before they'll come into a healthcare provider for many conditions. And so that 60, 90, and 120 days can be an eternity. Part and parcel to that, you have a core curriculum comparison that I've passed out. It's the last sheet in your handout. It looks like that. This was a comparison of the 2005-2006 core curriculum of the Doctor of Chiropractic four-year degree versus the Doctor of Physical Therapy four-year degree at Pacific University in Forest Grove. This was compiled by chiropractic student Seth Fortier and Megan Wright, who is a master's in physical therapy, who graduated in 2004 at Boston University School of Physical Therapy and understands these issues. If you look down at the core curriculum of the Doctor of Chiropractic, the students there are required to go through 144 clock hours and physical diagnosis. Nowhere in the core curriculum of the Doctor of Physical Therapy are there specific hours covering physical diagnosis. Also, in general and clinical pathology, again, pathology, the study of diseases and their characteristics. Clinical pathology is a study of diseases and their characteristics primarily by laboratory means, blood chemistries, tissue samples, very part and parcel to physical diagnosis. The kids at chiropractic school take right around 150 hours. The doctor of physical therapy, 15 hours, which is, in our view, inadequate. microbiology and public health, the chiropractic students take right at 140 hours. The doctor of physical therapy, 15 hours. Clinical lab, blood chemistry, knowing what to order when you suspect certain types of possible conditions that you need to rule in or rule out. Clinical lab, 60 hours at Western States. There's no indication they receive any blood chemistry or clinical lab training. Coercive and differential diagnosis, 48 hours. There's no indication in the syllabi of the doctor of physical therapy program they receive any hours in differential diagnosis. Gastroenterology diagnosis, gastrorespiratory diagnosis, and genital urinary survey. The students at Western States take 36 hours and 60 hours in those areas. And very important to musculoskeletal conditions, especially spine-related and extremities, is X-ray diagnosis. The students at the four-year chiropractic school take some 388 hours versus introduction to medical imaging for PTs, 15 hours. The proof in the pudding and deficiencies in their training relative to diagnosis are the total hours of the four-year chiropractic school amount to 4,896 hours versus 2,730 hours for the physical therapy training, some 2,100 hours less, and many of those hours are in the field of diagnosis. So our concern is why expanding direct access, it jeopardizes public safety. They have, Tracy indicated that, in fact, they have low malpractice instances of occurrences. However, we would say that a great majority of the physical therapy patients are triaged first by usually a medical physician, PCP. And so it's what we would say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is our final take-home message is simply if the physical therapists wish to be true first contact portal of entry healthcare providers, they simply need to raise their core curriculum requirements. Chair, members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Yes. Senator George.
Doctor, I'm looking through my file, and boy, do I have a lot of information in this file. Get your doctorate online? Have you seen this?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe that's from Boston University, which is where Megan graduated. You can do your doctorate in physical therapy, a good portion of it online, distance learning, with some weekend on-site training. That's what that's regarding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just curious if that shocked me to a certain extent, particularly when you put it with the comparison of the requirements for the degree. Could I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
The amendments remove the issue of the doctorate of physical therapy, the -7s. You guys have an opinion on that? Or?
Well, we, Mr. Chair, Senator George, we think that's appropriate. Tying the term doctor implies a certain, has a certain connotation to the public. And when you tie that to direct access or expanded access, they originally asked for full direct access, unlimited. It constitutes a public safety issue. They simply do not get the diagnostic skill sets to, in fact, recognize the red flags that can be life-threatening diseases masquerading as simple musculoskeletal conditions. They simply need to raise those core curriculum, the core curriculum bar, add those skill sets to the core curriculum of the doctor of physical therapy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Dr. Joel Agresta, and I also am here in opposition to House Bill 2386, primarily on the basis of it being a public safety issue.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Out of curiosity, you've traveled over 100 miles. Where are you from?
I don't know that it's been 100 miles. I'm from Portland area.
Oh, that's a long way out.
Yeah. It was tough getting here.
That's a long way from Salem. Different world.
It was a bit tight getting here. I come to this from kind of a unique perspective. I am both a licensed physical therapist in Oregon and a licensed chiropractic physician. I've been practicing in private practice for over 23 years. I've been an adjunct professor at the Western States Chiropractic College for 18 years, and that is my perspective on this. What I'd like to do is express an opposition and try to explain, and I will be brief here. I want to explain to you the difference between having a general portal of entry diagnostic skills and evaluation of musculoskeletal injuries. Their education, meaning physical therapist education, simply does not rise to the level required of a portal of entry physician. At times, serious pathology may mimic a musculoskeletal condition, and without proper training and diagnosis, a physical therapist could easily attempt to mistreat as if it was a musculoskeletal condition. To make some distinctions, I want to go to what physical therapists say about diagnosis. And for this, I'm going to an article from the Journal of Neurological Physical Therapy in 2004, where a physical therapist wrote an article called Neurological Differential Diagnosis for Physical Therapy. In that article, they state that diagnosis is a process of determining the nature of a condition by way of examination, and that a medical diagnosis is characteristically based on the pathophysiology of a condition. Immediately, they make a distinction between a medical diagnosis and a physical therapy diagnosis. They also, in that article, state that the American Physical Therapy Guide to Physical Therapy Practice and the American Physical Therapy Association's Normative Model of Physical Therapist Professional Education defines a physical therapy diagnosis as both a process and a label in which physical therapists perform an evaluation in order to provide a diagnosis that identifies the impact that a condition has on function. What they're saying here is that the level of skill set that they have allows them to determine the function of an individual, what their impairment or disability may be, how they walk, how far they can move a joint, that type of what their muscle tone is. That is the evaluation that they do. There is a difference between evaluating functional impairment and diagnosing physiopathology. Here is another quote directly from that article. Within the profession, it is well recognized that physical therapists do not determine the pathology or etiology of disease. The medical diagnosis is the pathologic and etiological diagnosis that is determined by the physician as a result of the medical differential diagnosis process. For instance, history, physical exam, laboratory findings, radiological findings, and other medical diagnostic tests. This is the physical therapy literature making a clear distinction between a physical therapist's functional evaluation and a physician's pathophysiological diagnosis. Physical therapists are responsible for the safety and appropriate treatment of individuals in their care. If physical therapists are allowed to expand their direct access to the public without referral, their lack of education and diagnosis would be a threat to public safety and put patients at risk. Thank you. I'm prepared to answer questions if you'd like.
Thank you. Davina Davia?
Diva.
Diva, would you come up, please? And Bob and I, would you come up? Go ahead.
For the record, Senator Morissette and other members of the committee, my name is Diva Benitez, and I'm a physical therapist. I have recently retired as the director of the School of Physical Therapy at Pacific University, and currently I am on the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and I represent the board at the meeting. Although later if you have questions regarding any of the testimony that was previously presented, I would be happy to make some comments. As you have in front of you, there's a letter from James Hyder, who's the executive director. And as he states, the board has spent thoughtful consideration about this bill, and the entire board supports the bill, and we feel that the extension of time is appropriate. As a way of referencing, because our primary job as the board members of the licensing board is to protect public safety, we have a statistic that we are presenting to you where it says that since February of 2001, which just as a reference year time has been taking, which is 6 years since we've had, until today it's 6 years, the board has received 241 complaints, which resulted in board investigation. Of the 241 complaints, only one complaint dealt with a license practicing beyond the day, the 30-day limit, without referring to a practitioner. A licensee was practicing for beyond the 30-day limit. That complaint was not filed by a patient, and to date, the board has no record of any patient injuries relative to physical therapy practice without referral. So it's my sixth year now as a member of the board, and we have yet to have a complaint which indicates that a patient was injured by the practice of direct access by a physical therapist. There are other complaints. Some of the other complaints may deal with the misuse of aids, with fraud that may occur, inappropriate record keeping, but none of them have dealt with an injury. So it supports some of the previous testimony that was given by Tracy, saying that physical therapists have been very safe in how they work with patients and how they treat them. So at this point, I would like to pass on to Bob Nee, who is one of the main instructors at the School of Physical Therapy.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, thanks for the introduction, Diva. I've been on faculty at the School of Physical Therapy at Pacific University for the past 8 years. I'm also here on behalf of Dr. Richard Rutt, who is our program director. He's not able to be here today. The written testimony is co-signed by him that we prepared together. We're in the midst of final exams, and he's not able to be here today. Some issues I'd like to address would be to, again, try to emphasize the process that we go through as physical therapists related to this discussion of differential diagnosis. The things that we do as physical therapists is we gather clinical information to see whether a patient's problem appears to be consistent with a musculoskeletal complaint. And that information is based on asking them questions about the nature and behavior of their symptoms. It involves asking them questions about their personal medical history. It involves asking them questions about their family medical history to see if there are any potential risk factors or what are referred to as red flags that may indicate the possibility of a non-musculoskeletal problem. And then gathering that information, we would kind of sort of come down to sort of basically making three types of decisions, which is outlined on the top of page 2 of the written testimony, where we feel that a patient's appropriate for physical therapy treatment and we would proceed. We feel that a patient can receive physical therapy treatment safely, but there may be some aspects of their problem where we have concerns that would require an appropriate referral to a medical practitioner for those things to be sorted out and further modification or change in physical therapy management based on those findings of that medical practitioner. Or the third may be that we feel that this patient is not appropriate for physical therapy until there is review of their condition by a medical practitioner. So we are in no way attempting to make a specific medical disease process diagnosis. We're simply making a decision of does this patient have something that's amenable to physical therapy or not, and then taking action as appropriate. In terms of the educational comparison chart that was brought up in previous testimony, I would just like to say that the numbers that were listed for physical therapy education are inaccurate. I'm happy to at a later time answer the reasons why that may be inaccurate and offer those numbers if that's important to members of the committee. I also would like to emphasize that in Senator George's previous question about getting your doctorate online, I'd like to specify that that's specifically related to within the profession is called a transition Doctor of Physical Therapy degree. So someone who would go through that type of program is an already licensed physical therapist, has gone through an accredited physical therapy education program, and that is an additional educational process that they can go through. There is no way that someone would go through their entire physical therapy education online. I just wanted to make that clarification. And I think in the interest of brevity, I would end it at that there at that point and open it up to the committee members for any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Jeffrey Foster. Jeffrey Foster, are you okay? And Francesca Harper, would you come up, please? And we're going to try to keep testimony fairly brief.
Mr. Chairman, board members, I just was here today to stand with other chiropractors in opposition of this bill. I would just reiterate the fact that, nobody here is against physical therapy in the sense that we don't think that it's beneficial. There are a lot of chiropractors that perform physical therapy as well because it does have a benefit to patients. The question is a public safety issue, and we're referring to the what we saw and what we have as education requirements for a licensed physical therapist. We do not believe that is sufficient for the latitude provided in this bill. Thank you.
Hello. For the record, my name is Dr. Francesca Harper. I've been a practicing chiropractor for almost a year now, and I, too, support physical therapy, but I am against the House Bill 2386 and its amendments for the same issues that Dr. Sabo and Dr. Gresta presented earlier. It's just an educational issue. And also, I believe that the more we as health professionals work together to support a patient, the better they'll get. So the more we combine our resources, the better they'll do. And I had a case where a patient came in and presented with typical neck and low back problems, but once I did an x-ray, I found that the patient had an abdominal aortic aneurysm and had to get surgery within the week. And based on what physical therapists do, I'm sure if the history they would have referred on, but that may not have been enough time. Within 2 days, she was in for surgery. So, again, it's just a public safety issue. And thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have a couple of other people who are signed up. If you have something additional to add to the testimony, if you are a chiropractor, please come forward and add some additional information. Did you want to add something? Yeah, yes.
Senator Morissette and all senators here on this board. My name is Steve DeShaw, and I'm a chiropractic physician. I've had the opportunity to serve the public for 32 years, and I come from a very interesting position because I have a multidisciplined approach clinic where I have had medical physicians, physiatrists, acupuncturists, massage therapists, psychologists, naturopaths, and chiropractors all working together. All the people who have spoke today, I think, have spoke well of their profession, and I think the genuine consent of the chiropractors is that the amount of education and the safety factors are not being met when you undergo taking care of people with neuromusculoskeletal conditions. My perspective on that is simply that no matter what any of us do, there is a process called healing. And that healing takes place whether you see a physician, whether you see a caregiver, whether you see a friend, healing takes place. It's the time of healing that's taking place that is utilized or used up by certain endeavors that an individual undergoes or a practitioner undergoes, which may jeopardize the health of the person. And no matter what anybody does, healing will take place. When that healing takes place, it's permanent. And it's permanency of not getting something taken care of at the adequate time, during the adequate stage of repair process, is the thing that actually jeopardizes the public. Because that individual will have to live with what they get once the healing is finished. As a practitioner of 32 years, I've had the opportunity to treat just about every type of process that there is. I specialized in workers' comp for over 20 years. I see a great deal of automobile injury victims, and these are traumas. And the people who come in most often present with neuromusculoskeletal conditions. And one of the questions always asked is, how long has it been since this injury occurred? What have you done in the meantime? And at that point, we have a good understanding of whether that individual is going to get better because time has gone by. So my concern is that 30 days is one thing, 45 is another, 60 is another, and 90, they're healed. There's a problem with that. If they have not had the opportunity to be seen by somebody who may find that it is not just a neuromusculoskeletal condition, but a pathological condition. If I would entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to stand down for just a quick minute. Senator Cruz moves the -A7 amendments to House Bill 2386. Discussion? Seeing no discussion. So moved.
Chair, I move House Bill 2386 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, House Bill 2386 as amended will move. House Bill as amended has been moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger.
Excuse.
Senator
George. Aye.
Senator Ron Anderson.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
Aye. I will carry the bill. Bill moves to the Senate floor. Thank you. Next bill. Someone can bring that up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2687A is similar to a Senate bill that the committee heard a few months ago, Senate Bill 452. It requires health benefit plans to provide coverage for services rendered by licensed professional counselors or licensed marriage and family therapists acting within their scope of practice, that the plan covers services by other professionals providing same or similar services. On the House side, they added some additional amendments. So 2687 also increases the civil penalty for violation of...
I'm still having a hard time hearing.
I'm sorry. It increases the civil penalty that the Oregon Board of Licensing Professional Counselors and Therapists can issue for civil penalties from $1,000 to $2,500 per violation. Also directs the board to employ one or more persons to aid in an investigation and enforce licensing requirements. It makes the measure explicitly subject to provisions of the mental health parity statute. The committee does have before them the -A5 amendment, which just is some clarifying language that's one of, I believe someone's here to testify about. The committee also does have before them a fiscal statement, and I do want to point to the last paragraph, which is a recommendation from LFO that because the board will need additional position authority to employ one or more persons, LFO recommends that the bill ultimately go to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have the list? Oh, Representative Maurer. Of course, I did not see you there. Sorry about that. Representative Maurer, welcome.
Welcome.
And welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, mm-hmm. Senator George. It's an honor to be in front of this august body. I am...
Wow. Bill.
See, I'm learning. I'm a freshman, but I'm...
Yeah.
Representative Ron Maurer, representing House District 3, which is most adjusting county, including Grants Pass and King Junction. And I'm here in support of 2687A, and I believe that there may be a few more small amendments, and I believe I would be in support of those, have not seen that. But LPCs are licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists, I believe, deserve to be treated the same as other counselors in the state of Oregon. This bill does not do anything that many insurance companies currently do in other policies. These people provide a valuable service as a retired Army major and a recent veteran of our conflict, although I was never overseas, been activated twice since 9/11. The need for additional LPCs and LMFTs is significant in the state of Oregon. And I also believe that although this may be construed as a mandate, and quite possibly it is a mandate, that the issue is about supply and demand, that the demand for these services is substantial, and that the supply of providers and through some insurance policies is too small. And so we have this great body of knowledge out there that can be of benefit to patients, and I think it's incumbent upon us to lower the bar and not create hurdles. Oregon is really good about creating hurdles for professionals to practice in the state, and I think that it's about time that, along with this bill, that in many of the other professional areas that we revisit some of those hurdles, and maybe it's to the benefit and would increase access for all Oregonians if we could revisit those professional standards. Having said that, I will end and take any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mary Lou, would you come up, please? And Gina Nickel, would you come up, please? They have two individuals who have traveled over 100 miles, and they appear down next.
Senator Morissette. Representative Peter Buckley is behind us to testify on behalf. He just came in.
Peter, Representative Buckley, would you come up, please?
Thank you, sir.
Representative Escobar, not to be seen. He will be here later.
Go ahead. Senator, thank you so much. For the record, my name is Peter Buckley, State Representative, District 5, South Jackson County. Thanks for your time and consideration of this bill today. As you know, Mr. Chair, that we've been working on this issue for a good length of time. We were able to amend it in the House with cooperation from the insurance companies. We were able to add a consumer protection part to the bill as well. The folks involved in this field, who, as you know, are very highly trained, qualified care providers, strongly felt was needed in order to protect people, to make sure they receive the services that they expected, the quality they expect. And in a nutshell, this bill gives highly trained health care professionals the chance to practice in the state of Oregon, regulated by a board like many other health professionals. And in there has been the use of the word mandate, and I would like to counter that and say this actually is not a mandate. This is an opening up of the process, the paneling process, to allow licensed family and marriage therapists and licensed special counselors to apply their trade as part of the panels, like every other mental health professional who's regulated in our state. to my mind, it's an issue of fairness and an issue of access to health care services, mental health care services for Oregonians. And there are people here who have spent a lot of time and energy on the bill, and they're able to help us get it through the House with a unanimous vote in committee and an overwhelming vote on the House floor. Because, again, if I can repeat this, just off Senator Moss, come in. Hello, Senator. Good afternoon. If I can repeat, we worked really hard to make sure we made the specific changes that the insurance companies needed to make sure this would not be a mandate that would cause policies to increase in price, that this would be a way to open up their panels to qualified professionals and to allow access to these services for Oregonians. And with that, I will pass on the microphone to my colleagues here or take questions as your preference.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Morissette, we have Sean Cruz from Senator Gordley's office.
Oh, okay. Sean, would you like to come up, please? Welcome, Sean.
Thank you. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz. I'm Senator Gordley's chief of staff and standing in for her to testify before you today. She would echo what Representative Buckley just said regarding the legislation. She wanted me to note that she chairs the Mental Health Caucus. She is very strongly interested in the issue and hopes to see you move this bill to the floor for a vote.
Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lou Brophy from Jacksonville, with my psychotherapy office located in Medford. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Oregon and have been a licensed marriage family therapist in California since 1981. So I'm very appreciative to Representative Buckley, Representative Maurer, and Sean Cruz from Senator Gordley's office for testifying on our behalf. House Bill 2687 began out of my frustration on behalf of my clients last September. I realized two astounding things. Number one, that in Oregon, there were people in practice who were not accountable to a regulatory board to abide by a code of ethics in their treatment of clients. And secondly, whose background and training had never been verified. Now, I gave you a packet today, and I put that in pink, a public disclosure statement, so that you would know that every licensed professional counselor and licensed marriage family therapist is obligated to give their clients a public disclosure statement, and the bottom half of that lavender-colored sheet tells you what the code of ethics is when you're a client, and at the bottom of the sheet it gives you the board's address and phone number.
Is that lavender?
That's lavender, okay. Senator Cruz.
Can I get it? I'm just a farm boy.
Senator Morissette in committee, I knew that you were colorful, so there are several color sheets in that packet. But in any event, that is a means by which there can be an accountability loop. So clients can, in fact, contact the board if there is any question about a code of ethics. And the second thing that distressed me is that clients were referred to me because of my training, but they were precluded from mental health care with me because their insurance would not reimburse for my services because I was an LPC. That was sort of flabbergasting to me. So many of those clients chose to see nobody. See, I'm a great believer in affordable and accessible mental health care. And at that point, they could not have access. And even when you provide clients in Southern Oregon with a sliding scale, many of them cannot afford it out of pocket. And compassion is one of the key characteristics of a good therapist. I mean, that is just not okay. So with that frustration, I phoned Peter Buckley, and we met for coffee last September 28th. And then I met with Representative Sal Esquivel. So the bill was born in the Rogue Valley. And when I met with them, I took two sections, consumer protection and consumer choice. And in the sausage-making process that you call the legislation, somehow the consumer protection piece got to be an amendment, you know. Surprise me. But anyway, there it is. So it is bipartisan purple legislation from Southern Oregon, which is now a statewide coalition. So my basic points here are that House Bill 2687, the Buckley-Esquivel Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice Bill, is based on the Mental Health Parity Bill, which you passed last session. It is basically a modification of that. And House Bill 2687 simply includes licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage family therapists. Get this, if the original legislation was in the 1980s, but our board, the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, did not even start licensing people till 1991. So, of course, we could not have been included. However, we can and should be included now in a law that mandates insurance reimbursement for LCSWs and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. There you have in your packet the blue sheet that does the comparison of the training and the education and the requirements. So whatever is true for licensed clinical social workers and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners should also apply for us. And I just maybe need to make this point. We are not social workers. There is a difference in training. And when we work in a treatment team, you see those perspectives differently. Social workers are more geared toward case management, toward discharge planning, toward placement of children in homes and placement of adults and accessing entitlement services for clients. Therapists are more geared towards specifically providing psychotherapy counseling services. So that's just a difference. I would say that another important point about House Bill 2687 is it frees up about 1,900 licensed professional counselors and LMFTs to serve the people of Oregon. And particularly our rural counties are underserved in terms of mental health care access. That is a serious problem. And we have in your packet also, and others will speak to this point, that House Bill 2687 will reduce overall health care costs, as many research studies shows. I just gave you on your bright yellow sheet a list of a summary of the studies. And then, of course, the biggest thing is that, from my point of view, passing House Bill 2687 will keep licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage family therapists from leaving Oregon's mental health field because they can't make a living at the vocation for which they've trained for years. I'm very, very committed to my vocation. And I want to be able to practice. But we've got therapists going out of business, going into debt. And I don't think it is fair, as one of the representatives said, that we be devalued by a state in which we have longed to serve. Now, just this afternoon, this isn't on my sheet, Betsy from Kaiser came to me with some Kaiser amendments. Kaiser dropped them off with legislative counsel just last night. So we glanced at them, but I can't support those amendments because I'm not a lawyer, until we had those reviewed. Because our bill has been so carefully constructed by legislative counsel to as modeled by the mental health parity bill. Thank you, Senator Morissette. Thank you, Chair.
Gina. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We wholeheartedly support House Bill 2687 and ask that you do the same. This bill is not an unfunded mandate, and I repeat, it is not an unfunded mandate. The intent of this bill is to create parity for equally trained members of the mental health field. In fact, insurance already covers LPCs, LCSWs, and licensed marriage and family therapists if they are employed by a local community mental health system or a hospital. The difference comes when they want to hang out their private shingle. That's really an inequity that you can fix today. This bill will help correct insurance-paid inequality among clinical providers with equal training. And in the advent of the new health care reform, this has the potential to lower health care costs by providing more access to care at an earlier stage of problematic mental health issues. You know, the State Hospital Master Plan, Phase 2, recommends investment in community services. Page 34 of that report shows that we need $105 million in upfront community costs. Senators, you know that amount of money will not go into that bill. Passage of House Bill 2687 will help ease the pressure by providing greater access to earlier care through an expanded workforce that already exists. With that, I'll take any questions.
Yes.
Have you looked at the Dash 5 amendments?
I have not seen them.
Okay. Basically, they're changing the word health benefit plan. So whenever a health benefit plan is changed to group health insurance. So health benefit plan is changed to group health insurance. And I don't know, I know what group is, so that means this would only apply to group insurance rather than...
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, just without saying that in front of me, but what you're describing, that means that this would apply to very, very few people, a lot less people. If that wording has changed,
and I was just curious if health insurance plans, group health insurance plans, at this point in time, have licensed professional counselors and therapists.
They do if they're tied to a hospital or a community mental health center.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the same thought as I was looking at Dash 5. Where did they come from? Do we know the source?
Senators, I believe they came from Kaiser, and they're here to
talk about
them. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Tucker.
Yes.
Mary Lou.
Uh-huh.
Some of those jokes were kind of...
They're off color.
No,
they were so corny.
They weren't off color. They were just a little on the lame side.
No.
But some of them were very good.
No,
so
no, look, off color.
No, she dropped by my office a
joke. Oh, I thought you were talking about. Okay, let's get back to the serious business.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Senator Chris.
Life or death issue. Who is going to testify about the Dash 5 amendments? Would you come up, please? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Kaiser Permanente, and I believe you have the Dash 5s in front of you. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? We have tried very hard to work with the LPCs to not oppose this bill. And in order to do that, on the House side, we worked out some amendments with them very quickly, trying to reach the deadline of April 30th. As you recall, I'm sure you recall, bills had to be out of their committee of origin on that date. We talked with them about the fact that we might have to make additional changes after we looked more carefully at what we were trying to do. And that is, in fact, what happened. If you look at, let me just tell you what we're doing here. Mental health parity is a law that applies only to group health insurance policy plans. And if you look at Section 2, which we're changing, where we change the word health benefit plan to group health insurance, that is just making it doubly clear that this law applies to group health insurance in the same way that other parts of the mental health parity law do. If you go along line 7 a little further, the bill referred to ORS 743-522 as the defining statute regarding group health insurance plans. That statute actually doesn't cover healthcare service corporations or HMOs. It only covers other group health insurance plans. So we changed it to 743-522, which would apply this bill also to healthcare service corporations and HMOs. Kaiser Permanente is a healthcare service corporation. The reason we changed the language from health benefit plan to group health insurance is because that mirrors the language that's in the DOT 522 part of the chapter. So there's no practical implication from the change in language as far as changing it from applying to an individual policy or a group policy. This bill already applied only to group policies because it was applied through the mental health parity law. The one other change that we made is on line 8 of the A engrossed bill. You'll see that we added the words behavioral health. So it reads, provides for coverage for behavioral health services performed by a physician, psychologist, clinical social worker, etc. The idea behind that was some people purchase individual health insurance policies that cover only medical treatment and don't cover any mental health treatment at all. And we wanted to make it clear that in those cases when an individual policy had been purchased that was only for medical treatment, that this law wouldn't force insurance companies to cover the services of a licensed professional counselor any more than they would have to cover the services of any other mental health professional. Do you want to take another crack at that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I think what you said is clear. So I would answer any questions.
Didn't seem very clear to me when I was saying that. So.
No, it seemed clear, but I have some questions. So would this, when you compare then licensed professional counselors and therapists, would this put them on a par with clinical social workers with this amendment? Now, if we don't change the amendment, or if we don't put the amendment in, does that mean that they would actually have more opportunity for a reimbursement than a social worker?
Mr. Chair and Senator Monis Anderson, I don't think it's not an absolutely for sure that they would have more opportunity for payment than those other mental health professions, but it's not quite as clear, to be honest, especially the issue having to do with individual health policies that were purchased only for medical treatment. In a case like that, you could make an argument, the way the bill's written right now, that the insurance company did have to pay for LPC care, even though the policy was only purchased for medical care.
Oh, okay. Now I'm starting to understand. Okay, so there are group plans that do not cover behavioral health and just medical care. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it had
individual.
Yes, individual.
Okay,
that's what our concern is individual plans.
Okay.
And the other thing is that if you don't make these changes, this law won't apply to healthcare service corporations specifically.
I see puzzled looks on the faces of the proponents.
Mr. Chairman, John Powell, again for the record, if you look on line 14. The ORS citation 743-556 is the Mental Health Parity Act. That act begins with language similar to when a group health insurance policy provides. It's very clear that the Mental Health Parity Act applies to group health insurance and not individual policies. And that historically, while some mandates do apply to individual policies, historically, mandates have not been added to individual policies because they are so price sensitive. And many times people purchase those when they're between jobs and that sort of thing, and they're having to pay for it themselves. And so that they're very, very price sensitive. And that's why a lot of the mandates, including mental health parity, did not apply to individual policies. By far, the majority of the people in Oregon are insured through group insurance and not through individual insurance policies.
So, a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So, there'll be more opportunity for licensed professional counselors and therapists to be covered or to be reimbursed with this bill, because I had heard that from Ms. Nickel that there would be very few that would be affected, I mean, that could take advantage if this was changed to group.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonus Anderson, the vast majority of people have group health insurance coverage as opposed to individual coverage. Right now, the rule is that health insurers are not to sell individual policies to employers of more than one person. So the small groups are 2 to 25 employees and soon to be 2 to 50, I think. And that's a guaranteed issue product that insurance companies who sell insurance in Oregon must sell to any applicant who applies on a guaranteed issue basis. So most small groups would use that vehicle anyway because there's no medical underwriting. On an individual policy, there's medical underwriting, and if you are declined, you have to go to the high-risk pool, OMIP, which is the fallback for people who are uninsurable through the private insurance market.
Okay. Let me just ask, with this amendment, you're okay with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Regent's position is and continues to be that we do not recommend bills that mandate cost for coverage at this point.
And you consider this a mandate?
We do.
Okay. Now, I'm going to take a minute here. Maybe we'll even stand down. We are going to move this bill to Ways and Means. I'm not sure we have the votes to move it. Even if it didn't have a fiscal, I'm not sure we have the votes to move it to the floor. There is a fiscal impact. It has to go to Ways and Means. So we are able to move it to Ways and Means. You will have an opportunity as proponents to address this before the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know. The fiscal showed up, and I guess that's because somebody wants staff people involved. Now, if you don't want staff people involved, you may argue that in Ways and Means, and it may move out expeditiously. The next question is, do the proponents want the amendment? And if you do want the amendment, we can move the amendment and send it to Ways and Means. I guess if you don't want the amendment, we can send it to Ways and Means without the amendment. So I will stand down for about 3 minutes while you decide if you want the amendment or not, and we will move the bill to Ways and Means. We'll continue with this. Go ahead. Who wants to respond to our concern?
Senator Morissette, committee members, for the record, again, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And what we would like to do at this time, we ask that you pass it out without this amendment. We'd like time to take a look at this amendment with our attorneys, clarify it, work with John and Betsy, and perhaps clarify this in Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Interesting what's going on in Ways and Means. They are doing substantive amendments, but they're also saying they can't talk about them down there, so which is a problem. And I guess as I'm reading 743566, which the bill does reference, it is talking about group health insurance policies. I mean, that's clear. And I guess when I read the proposed amendment, it's it's clarifying that in the bill. And so...
And I have not seen those amendments and would like to run them by.
Why don't we then just carry this over until Monday, if that's okay, give you time, and we will... I think it would. We think it would be an advantage to have the amendment, to go to Ways and Means with the amendment. But then... Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, and committee. I'm Marcus Berglund, licensed marriage and family therapist and president-elect of Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Because we were only apprised of these amendments really when this hearing started, I just want to let you know, though, that we have access to an attorney in D.C. I'd call him right now if he was there, but I know he is not. And so we can, although he works hard, he will be able to be accessed by me tomorrow morning, and so Monday is more than fair.
Okay.
And it looks like, superficially, it looks fine, but it changes the language of the Oregon law as stated, and that's my concern.
And that's I understand reasonable. That. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were aware of this amendment earlier. Or, Okay. Well, there has been... I heard rumors that there was a compromise situation being worked out, and I thought maybe you were involved in that.
No, my hope is that it just clarifies things. It would be great to work.
Well, we are prepared to send this bill to Ways and Means. There is a fiscal, it has to go to Ways and Means, and so you can come back and let us know, and we can move the bill Monday to Ways and Means, with or without the amendment.
That's great. More than fair. Thank you, sir.
But I appreciate that, Ms. Chair. I am not satisfied with sending an unfinished product down.
Oh,
so
we
need to resolve that here.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so we will close the public hearing. And I'm sorry that we didn't have a chance to hear everybody, but we are going to move the bill. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3096. Jim Davis, would you please come forward and apprise us of the information?
Not him again.
Yeah. Okay. Could you give us a rundown, please, on House Bill 3096?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3096 modifies requirements for licensure as indenturist. Also exempts indentures licensed in a state, District of Columbia, Canada, or territory with equivalent licensing standards. Indentures who have engaged in full-time active practice for at least 2 years preceding application submission and persons who have passed equivalent examinations from an examination requirement to be required of other denturists.
Okay. Mr. Davis. Okay. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Denturist Association, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, and the United Seniors of Oregon. We're here to urge your support of House Bill 3096, which is set to clarify language in the Oregon Denturist Statutes, which is ORS 680, around requirements for licensure to become a denturist in Oregon. Most of the proposed changes, as you can see if you're looking at a copy of the legislation, really is just a redoing of the language, as you can see in different aspects here. And if I could take you to line 19, what is being taken out is furnishes satisfactory evidence that the applicant has successfully completed, and instead puts a very similar language right up above it in line 17 and 18, and then talks about providing the agency with official transcripts. So really it's clarifying to make it more specific as to what they need to provide. And you can see with the agency documentation of 1,000 hours at the bottom of page 1 that essentially, once again, is just a changes in language. And this is part of a process that's been going on through the Office of Health Licensing and the Denture Technology Board over the last year, along with the Denturist Association, to just kind of look at the language and begin to make some clarifications and clean some things up. You can see on page 2 on line 3,
takes out performs to the satisfaction of the agency on and just puts passing a written and practical examination. So there's no changing, just language changes. The one thing that it does change that doesn't currently exist is it adds into language the District of Columbia and Canada that are areas along with Washington State where denturists could come in and practice in the state of Oregon if they have equivalent education and background. The reason that we added Canada in there, that Canadians have the most distinguished practice of denturism in the world. They are the most experienced, the best trained. They have to go to school for even longer. They are a top of the line program and throughout all the provinces of Canada. And what we're looking at here is with the explosion of boomers onto the senior scene and increases in other numbers around people who will need dentures, we just don't have enough denturists in this state. We have about 100 plus practicing denturists. We really need more individuals who can serve these populations. So they have to meet very stringent requirements, but certainly if the Canadians wanted to come down, which is probably not that likely, we would welcome them and welcome their expertise. I do want to emphasize, and one area that I need for you to look very briefly at, is we made a change in the end of the bill in line 24 through 26. Instead of saying 3,500 hours in 5 years in terms of the practice you would need to have to be able to come in, what we're saying is that a license, it must be a full-time denturist for 2 years. And so I added up these totals before I came up here. And if you're a full-time denturist for 2 years and work a 40-hour week, you'll end up having a little under 4,000 hours. 3,840 is what I came up with, but I think it's a little higher than that. So actually, it's more than 3,500. It's just for the denturist, it makes more sense for us to bring in and ask for full-time practice, somebody who's been out in the field full-time for that period. So, but it doesn't change the hour requirement in any way. Actually adds to it. So there's really no lessening of educational requirements. There's really nothing that happens in this bill that changes any of our requirements or our standards for denturism. It's just simply some clarifications that we felt needed to be made.
Yes. Thank you. A few questions. Number one, to your 40-hour. I know my dentist works a 4-day week. A denturist could work a 4-day week as well and be full time. So I'd just nitpick you there a little bit. But the real question is: there a national standard or a national test? And after that, what sort of reciprocity do we have with other states at this point?
Okay. Senator Cruz and Senator Morissette and the rest of the committee, right now we have reciprocity of Washington State.
That's it.
That's it.
Okay.
And Washington State has a very equivalent program to ours. As a matter of fact, it was fashioned after ours, and I helped write that statute up there. And it's actually better because it came along later, and we were able to make it more the ideal. And so they definitely have actually written into law reciprocity. We felt Canadians have a very high standard that would certainly meet or exceed our standards, that's why we wanted to add them. But we want to be very careful. Right now, there are 6 states in the union that have denturist programs. And the Northwest is kind of the bastion of the field, because you have Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana, all 4 states having been voted in by initiative. And then you have Maine. And I think I'm forgetting Arizona. Those are the states that have denturist programs. And I'm sorry, Senator, what was the first question?
The other one, obviously, if that's the only states with programs, there's probably not a national standard, although is there. And I always look for these things and trying to get to reciprocity and for people with equivalent education and training to be able to go anywhere to practice their craft, sort of thing. And And clearly, if we're having problems, then we could entice people from California who have equivalent training, but you don't have reciprocity, so obviously they'd have to come in and pass a test and also demonstrate that they've been a full-time denturist for now 2 years. So
right, or been in the practice, an active practice of denture technology, which could be a lab technician as well.
Okay.
I mean, you have to be making dentures full-time for that equivalency, or over a longer period as well. But in terms of a national standard, at this point there is not a national standard, but the National Denturist Association has been working on, and they have drafted national standards, but you know, how do you, when you say a national standard, we don't have that many states at this point, but if you were to look at the tests and the programs that are considered the national models, it would be Oregon and Washington.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay. No other questions. We'll close the public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3096 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3096 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator
Aye.
Senator Vonnegut.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Excuse.
Vice Chair.
Aye. House Bill 3096 moves to the floor.
Thank you very much.
Due pass recommendation, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill.
I know I shouldn't ask.
Proudly, he will carry the bill, and he will expound upon it for at least 10 minutes.
Mr. Chair, this isn't the first time we've dealt with this issue in this building, you and I.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Please wear your dentures.
Wear your dentures. Glue them in. Okay. Do I get free dentures on this?